says, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Have you remembered this weekend is the Ides of March, the notorious day forever linked to the assassination of Caesar, Julius Caesar, in 44 BC. The death of Caesar made the Ides of March a turning point in Roman history, one of the markers of the transition from the Roman Republic to the Roman Empire. So I thought, what better time to spotlight this season's well-received crop of histories, of the people, places, and events that impact us to this day? Our topic today, turning points to ponder, as we turn to page one of the book report. Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan, 1839 to 1842, by William Dalrymple, is a brilliant retelling of one of the West's greatest imperial disasters in the East, one that holds incredible relevance today. Using newly discovered primary sources from archives in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Russia, and India, Dalrymple, award-winning historian, journalist, and travel writer, gives us a comprehensive account of the spectacular first battle for Afghanistan, the British invasion of 1839. Nearly 20,000 British and East India Company troops poured through mountain passes from India into Afghanistan to establish a puppet on the country's throne. But after a little more than 2 years, the Afghans rose in answer to the call for jihad. The first Anglo-Afghan war ended with an entire army of what was then the most powerful military nation in the world ambushed and destroyed. Only one British man made it through. Dalrymple takes us beyond this infamous battle. With balanced insight, he illuminates the uncanny similarities between the West's first disastrous entanglement with Afghanistan and the situation today. He explores the complexity of Afghanistan's age-old tribal rivalries, the stranglehold they have on the nation's politics, and the way in which they ensnared both the British in the 19th century and NATO forces in the 21st. Neil Shah narrates.
After the defeat at Nimla, Shah Shuja experienced a prolonged period of humiliation and exile. His wanderings were made all the more perilous by the fact that he was carrying on his person the single most valuable jewel in the world. For several months, Shuja visited darbars of his allies, asking for their help in mounting a campaign to regain his kingdom and depose Shah Mahmud and the Barakzais. One night, a former courtier named Atta Mohammed invited him to stay at the great fortress of Attak, which guards the principal crossing over the Indus. There, according to Mirza Atta, they invited Shah Shuja to a private party, where they served sweet watermelons and started playfully throwing the melon skins at each other. But the jest, bit by bit, turned to scorn and effrontery, and Shah Shuja soon found himself arrested, held first in Attak, then sent under close surveillance to Kashmir, where he was kept prisoner in a fort. The lancet was frequently held over his eyes, and his keeper once took him into the Indus, with his arms bound, threatening him with instant death if he didn't hand over the celebrated diamond. Wafa Begum, meanwhile, was loyally working to get him out. After her husband's defeat, she had made her way to Lahore, where, according to Sikh sources, she independently took it upon herself to negotiate a deal with the Sikh Maharaja, Ranjit Singh, offering him the Kohinoor if he helped release her husband from prison. Ranjit Singh agreed to her terms. In the spring of 1813, the Sikh leader sent an expedition to Kashmir, which defeated the governor who was holding Shuja and released him from his dungeon. Ranjit Singh then took the deposed Shah to Lahore. There he was separated from his harem, put under house arrest, and told to fulfill his part of his wife's bargain by handing over the diamond. The ladies of our harem were accommodated in another mansion to which we had, most vexatiously, no access, wrote Shuja in his memoirs. Food and water rations were reduced or arbitrarily cut off, our servants sometimes allowed to go and sometimes forbidden from going about their business in the city. He regarded this as a breach of the laws of hospitality, It was a display of oafish bad manners, he wrote, dismissing Ranjit Singh, his one-eyed captor, as both vulgar and tyrannical, as well as ugly and low-natured. Slowly, Ranjit increased the pressure. At the lowest ebb of his fortunes, Shuja was put in a cage, and according to his own account, his eldest son, Prince Timur, was tortured in front of him until he agreed to part with his most valuable possession.
We've just heard Return of a King by William Dalrymple. My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel is an authoritative and deeply personal narrative history of the State of Israel by Ari Shavit, one of the most influential journalists writing about the Middle East today. Facing unprecedented internal and external pressures, Israel is at a moment of existential crisis. Shavit draws on interviews, historical documents, private diaries and letters, as well as his own family story, to tell a riveting narrative that is larger than the sum of its parts. Paul Bomer narrates.
Is the idea of a Jewish state totally unfounded? I ask Dala. Don't the Jewish people have the right to self-determination? Aren't Jews allowed to have their own nation-state within the 1967 boundaries? Dala tells me that the Jewish people now living in the country have the right to self-determination. But one can understand why the Palestinians rejected the UN partition plan in 1947, and one must understand that there is no parity of rights here. There is no balance between my right and your right, he says. At the outset, the Jews had no legal, historical, or religious right to the land. The only right they had was the right born of persecution, but that right cannot justify taking 78% of a land that is not theirs. It cannot justify the fact that the guests went on to become the masters. At the end of the day, the ones with the superior right to the land are the natives, not the immigrants. The ones who have lived here for hundreds of years and have become part of the land just as the land has become a part of them. We are not like you. We are not strangers or wanderers or immigrants. For centuries we have lived upon this land and we multiplied. No one can uproot us. No one can separate us from the land, not even you. Dala was born in 1968 in the Galilee village of Turan. He studied hard and worked hard and made his way by himself. After excelling at the Hebrew University's School of Law, he became the first Arab law clerk in Israel's Supreme Court. In 1993, he opened what would become a flourishing law practice in Jerusalem, and in 1995, he was the co-founder of the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights, Adala. In 2000, Dala married Suad, a lawyer and television presenter. Their first son, Omar, was born in 2002. For two intense years in the mid-1990s, Mohammed and I were co-chairs of the board of the Association of Civil Rights in Israel, ACRI. So, as we travel north in his blue Mercedes, we conduct a conversation founded in a universe of shared values and concepts: human rights, minority rights, liberal democracy. But unlike previous conversations we have had, this time each of us brings with him his national history and perspective, and also his existential anxiety. This time Mohammed surprises me by unfurling for me his full worldview, and he tells me why he no longer believes in the partition of the land in a two-state solution. Growing up in a village, his identity was local, he tells me, the identity of a dutiful village son. Only at the university did he acquire a national Palestinian identity, and already then the two-state solution seemed to him artificial and insufficient. It did not solve the problem of the Arabs of 1948, the ones who remained in or returned to Israel after the war. Nor did it address the calamity of the Arabs expelled by the war. But when the Oslo Accords were signed in 1993, he was temporarily persuaded that the only viable solution was the two-state solution. Then, in 2000, he realized it was hopeless. The peace process was actually a process of subjugating the Palestinian people to Israeli will and preserving occupation. Israelis were not ripe for a historic conciliation. They were not willing to give Palestinians their elementary rights. So there was no way but struggle.
We've just heard My Promised Land by Ari Shavit. From the author who brought us Wild Swans, Zhong Tang, comes Empress Dowager Su Qi, the concubine who launched modern China. Su Qi, who lived from 1835 to 1908, is one of the most important women in Chinese history, widely credited with bringing China from a medieval empire into the modern age. At the age of 16, Su Qi was chosen as one of the emperor's numerous concubines. When he died in 1861, their 5-year-old son ascended the throne. Su Qi at once launched a palace coup against the regents appointed by her husband and made herself the real ruler of China, behind the throne, literally, with a silk screen separating her from her officials. In this groundbreaking biography, Zhong Tang vividly describes how Su Qi fought against monumental obstacles to change China. Under her rule, the ancient country attained the attributes of a modern state: industries, railways, electricity, the telegraph, and an army and navy with up-to-date weaponry. It was Su Qi who abolished gruesome punishments like death by a thousand cuts, and she put an end to foot binding. Su Qi had to deal with major national crises, including the Boxer Rebellion, wars with France and Japan, and an invasion by 8 allied powers. The book is both a panoramic depiction of the birth of modern China and an intimate portrait of a woman, a concubine, an absolute ruler, and a unique stateswoman. Jolene Kim performs the book.
The ruling family, the Aisin Jiōrōs, produced a succession of able and hardworking emperors who were absolute monarchs and made all important decisions personally. There was not even a prime minister, but only an office of assistance, the Grand Council. The emperors would rise at the crack of dawn to read reports, hold meetings, receive officials, and issue decrees. The reports from all over China were dealt with as soon as they arrived, and rarely was any business left undone for more than a few days. The seat of the throne was the Forbidden City, perhaps the largest imperial palace complex in the world. This rectangular compound covered an area of 720,000 square meters with a moat of proportional size. It was surrounded by a majestic wall some 10 meters high and nearly 9 meters thick at the base, with a magnificent gate set into each side and a splendid watchtower above each corner. Almost all the buildings in the compound displayed glazed tiles in a shade of yellow reserved for the court. In sunshine, the sweeping roofs were a blaze of gold. A district west of the Forbidden City formed a hub for the transportation of coal, bound for the capital. Brought from the mines west of Beijing, it was carried by caravans of camels and mules, wearing tinkling bells. It was said that some 5,000 camels came into Beijing every day. The caravans paused here, and the porters did their shopping from stores whose names were embroidered on colorful banners or gilded on lacquered plaques. The streets were unpaved, and the soft, powdery dust that lay on top in dry weather would turn into a river of mud after a downpour. There was a pervasive reek from a sewage system that was as antiquated as the city itself. Refuse was simply dumped on the side of the roads, left to the scavenging dogs and birds. After their meals, large numbers of vultures and carrion crows would flock into the Forbidden City, perching on its golden roofs and blackening them. Away from the hubbub lay a network of quiet, narrow alleys known as He Tong. This is where, on the 10th day of the 10th lunar month in 1835, the future Empress Dowager of China, Cixi, was born. The houses were spacious, with neatly arranged courtyards, scrupulously tidy and clean, in sharp contrast to the dirty and chaotic streets. The main rooms had doors and windows open to the south to take in the sun, while the north was walled up to fend off the sandy storms that frequently swept the city. The roofs were covered with gray tiles. The colors of roof tiles were strictly stipulated: yellow for the royal palaces, green for the princes, and gray for all others. Cixi's family had been government employees for generations. Her father, Hui Zheng, worked as a secretary and then a section chief for the Ministry of Officials. The family was well off. Her childhood was carefree. As a Manchu, she was spared foot binding, a Han practice that tortured their women for a millennium by crushing a baby girl's feet and wrapping them tightly to restrict their growth. Most other customs, such as male-female segregation, the Manchus shared with the Han. As a girl of an educated family, Cixi learned to read and write a little Chinese, to draw, to play chess, to embroider, and to make dresses, all deemed desirable accomplishments for a young lady. She was a quick and energetic learner and developed a wide range of interests.
That was Empress Dowager Cixi by Zheng Chang. Russell Shorto's Amsterdam, A History of the World's Most Liberal City, is an entertaining portrait of an incredibly unique place. Tourists know Amsterdam as a picturesque town of low-slung brick houses lining tidy canals. Student travelers know it for its legal brothels and hash bars. Art lovers know it for Rembrandt's glorious portraits. But the deeper history of Amsterdam, what makes it one of the most fascinating places on Earth, is bound up in its unique geography, the constant battle of the citizens to keep the sea at bay, and the democratic philosophy this enduring struggle fostered. Tolerance for free thinking and free love make it a place where, in the world of one of its mayors, craziness is a value. But the city has also fostered the deeper meaning of liberalism, one that profoundly influenced America's political and economic freedom. The author narrates.
The style has a formal aesthetic, which has its technical descriptors and philosophical socialist underpinnings. But to me, it simply embodies a reasonably pleasant combination of whimsy and stolidness. Brick, what could be more stolid, is the medium. Yet there is an infinity of playful variations. Rounded turret-like corners, embedded deco-ish sculptures that seem to mock the hardness of the material. A girl surrounded by rabbits. A baby holding up a doorway. Block-long apartment buildings that could have had an ocean liner as their inspiration. Or a wedding cake. The neighborhood is no more than 5 minutes by bike from the canal belt and the storied 17th-century heart of Amsterdam. But when developers were laying it out 100 years ago, they must have felt a need to connect the new area to the city's history. If Rembrandt visited the immediate area around my home, he might feel some familiarity. For even though this was swamp and fields in his time, the streets bear the names of many of the artists whom he groomed in his workshop or competed with for commissions. Frans van Mieris, who wrought exquisite small portraits of the wealthy class, Nicolas Maas, who often painted ordinary people at prayer and at meals and gave the same loving attention to a glistening loaf of bread or an earthen pitcher on a table as he did to the faces of his subjects, Philip Zwouwerman, who specialized in hunting scenes and was known to paint a mean horse. At the time my neighborhood came into being, all of those were figures of the grand past, so that the names Nicolas Maasstraat and Frans van Mierenstraat instantly gave the new neighborhood some of the luster of Amsterdam's Age of Glory, when it was, briefly and improbably, the greatest city in the world. To this day, the houses on those streets have dignified presence. But as you go farther away from the center, as we do on our morning trip, the houses get plainer. It seems the city fathers of a century ago did not want to dilute the grandeur of the Golden Age by spreading its names too far. On the other hand, in 1905, right at the time that the more distant part of the neighborhood was being laid out, the nearby Stedelijk Museum, the city's modern art museum, mounted the first exhibition in the country devoted to Vincent van Gogh. The Dutch artist had died only 15 years before. His home country had done its best to ignore him, but it was now obvious that they would have to pay attention. Yet at the same time, his name didn't carry bourgeois heft, and who knew if those thick swirls of bright color would withstand the test of time. As a result of what I imagine were considerations such as these, Vincent van Goghstraat, the only street in the area whose name is instantly globally recognizable today, is among the humblest, a single block of monotone dwellings. That street also signals the end of our little journey. As Anthony and I pass it, I hop off the bicycle, unstrap him, and set him on the sidewalk. While I ring the doorbell, he opens the mailbox flap, which is on his level, and hollers into it. The door is opened by a Moroccan woman in her 30s, wearing a headscarf, floor-length robe, and sandals. She has a kind face and smiles at Anthony as she tells him he's grown over the weekend. Nou, wat een grote jongen ben je. He plays a game, trying to scramble up the stairs to the next floor instead of going into her apartment. Iman and her husband have lived in Amsterdam for 10 years. They have 2 young daughters. Her husband drives a city bus. She is a licensed gastouder, literally guest parent, what in the U.S. would be called a daycare provider. Her 4-year-old, Marwa, emerges from behind her with a tangle of curls and big, deep eyes and says hello over and over very loudly. Then she tells me Anthony is ugly. Then she gives him a hug and hauls him into the apartment. Iman and I chat for a few minutes. Some weeks before, she asked if Anthony's mother and I would sign an immigration document in support of her sister, who wanted to come to Amsterdam to visit. I was confused at first. I thought one was required to get such statements of support for people who intended to emigrate, not who merely wanted to visit family. I subsequently learned that it was now necessary in the Netherlands for people from certain countries, read poor countries, or to be more precise, Muslim countries, to file extensive applications, including having residents vouch for them, even if all they wanted to do was see the canals and tulips.
That was Amsterdam, A History of the World's Most Liberal City, by Russell Shorten. Brad Meltzer, a Book Report favorite, is just out with an intriguing new title linked to his popular TV series, Brad Meltzer's Decoded. The book probes into 10 intriguing stories, everything from controversies surrounding John Wilkes Booth to Leonardo da Vinci, to that tragic day in Dallas 50 years ago. Of course, Brad is also the author of best-selling thrillers, including The Fifth Assassin. Now, let's get the inside scoop on his newest title, The 10 Greatest Conspiracies of All Times. Welcome, Brad. It's great to have you back with us on The Book Report.
Always nice to see you, Aline.
As a history lover myself, I loved a thought from your foreword. History is a giant game of telephone. What's vital is finding the first whisper.
And the sad part is that's the hardest part. We today have access to more information than any society in history. And we have, you know, newspapers, magazines, television, and of course the internet, which brings, you know, the Library of Alexandria to your bedroom in your pocket at any moment. The problem is we don't have facts. We lose facts. And these things are filled with so much misinformation, we don't even know what the truth is anymore. The great commodity is now the truth. And I said, that's what we want to bring back to history is, you know, the best story of all to me is the true story.
I've never heard of the Georgia Guidestones before. Where and what are they?
Yeah, so they're basically like an American Stonehenge, and they're just outside Atlanta in Georgia, of course. And what happened was, is back in, I think, 1980, a guy comes in the middle of the night, comes to the Granite Company, says, I want to build something that, it's kind of like a Stonehenge in the United States. He builds this multi-million dollar elaborate thing that has it's written commandments that are basically in the 8 of the top languages. So there's English and there's Russian and there's, you know, all these amazing commandments that basically say, you know, live in harmony with the universe, you know, don't rule nature. Well, nothing that anyone would disagree with. But then one of them basically says, keep the population under X amount of million people. And people read that and they say, wait a minute, that's far less than we have now. So is he talking about killing people or is this what it is? The interesting part about it is the guy says, you can never say to anyone who I am, that I must remain secret forever. And now when you say that this guy built a monument outside of Georgia, that he's going to forever remain secret, all I want to know is who he is. And the amazing part about the Georgia Guidestones is that psychics from around the world, when they come to that spot in Georgia, they say they feel something. Like the psychic prom is going to be held at this spot next year. And there is a psychic prom, by the way. I just want to be clear. And I love that that exists. And when Florida falls into the ocean, the big one hits and California's in the ocean, somehow this spot in Atlanta, outside Atlanta, is a safe zone. And so to me, the Georgia Guidestones just become one of the great conspiracies of all time.
How do you dress for the psychic prom?
Yeah, no, I listen, you should know. It comes to you in your dream. You know how to dress.
Who are the Rosicrucians and was Sirhan Sirhan a member?
So the Rosicrucians are one of the great old secret societies. Kind of some people link them to the Freemasons. I mean, you can find, of course, everything can be linked to the Freemasons. But they're really based on this guy named Rosenkreutz, who started this organization that he named after the Rosy Cross. That's where Rosicrucian gets its name from. And Sirhan Sirhan was a Rosicrucian. They dedicate themselves to what they call transformation and mental powers. And some people think that means, you know, ESP, as you I know you have. And Sirhan Sirhan, who famously killed Bobby Kennedy, was a Rosicrucian. But you know what he also was? He was a total psychopath who was suffering from mental illness. And he was a Rosicrucian by mail order. Now, I can be a bride by mail order. That doesn't make me a bride. So I don't really count. You know, I just hate when people take a sliver of history and try to make a bigger point about it. I mean, to say that this guy got a card in the mail and therefore every Rosicrucian is an evil person is just reckless. If you can find the evidence, go say what you want. But, you know, let's it's like saying we found the one bad Catholic person, Jewish person, name the person and say, you know, we should indict them all. And what is interesting is that when you look at the Georgia Guidestones from above, the guy whose name, who gave his name, played on that Rosencrantz and played on and said his fake name was based on that. And when you look at the Georgia Guidestones from above, they actually form a Rosy Cross, which is the symbol of the Rosicrucians. So many people link the Rosicrucians to the Georgia Guidestones, fairly or unfairly.
Tell us about the Spear of Destiny and its connection to Hitler.
Yeah, this was one of my favorite ones that we did in the book. And the Spear of Destiny is basically the spear that pierced Christ's side while he was on the cross. And for centuries, people say that it had powers, that everyone from Constantine to Napoleon all took power because they somehow touched the real cross. And what was interesting to me is whether you believe in magic powers or you think it's, you know, totally ridiculous, is the other person who chased this spear is a guy named Adolf Hitler. And you tell me that Adolf Hitler wants it, I want to know what it is, right? Immediately, I don't care what he wants, I want to know why he wants it so bad. And the interesting story about the Spear of Destiny is that the Vatican today says they have the original true spear. They say it's buried under St. Peter's and they have the real one. There's a museum in Vienna that says they have the real one. There's another one that say they have the real one. And there's a guy who I met who says that he knows someone who replaced Hitler's spear with actually a fake one, and that the real one is held by someone currently. What was interesting to me at the end of the story as we looked for it, one was you see how just insane Hitler's the Thule Society, which was his kind of secret society within the Nazi Party, was into the occult. They used to literally have their members. So at one point, the Germans were having their members have sex in cemeteries of German heroes because they thought the babies that were born from that conception would take on the attributes of the heroes that were buried in that cemetery. That is bringing it to a new level, right? That's when you stop and you go, what are these people doing here? And the amazing part for me was when I was approached a number of years years ago by a guy who we checked out his story. He's a worked for a very powerful man. We checked out with the police his story, verified where he worked, and he said that his former boss, who had the ear of a U.S. president, belonged to an organization that had the real spear. And it was amazing. He said the group that had it, it was a group that believes that God is the bad guy in the story, that the devil is the good guy in the story. And whether you think it's, again, all ridiculous or not, or what, you know, that they think that they're going to use the spear and take over the world, what I do believe is that they think it's real. And you don't need to evoke 9/11 to know what a group of fanatics with a religious cause can do in the name and do in terms of harm. And that's what scares me in the middle of the night. So you see the whole story in there. And it's really just one of those great conspiracies that you can't prove it, you can't disprove it. You can prove parts of it. And there are still people who think it's happening right now today. And that to me is, of course, the most terrifying part.
Yeah. Many of your fans know that you're a comic book author and enthusiast. You credit Leonardo da Vinci with the inspiration for Batman. How so?
You know, and it's not just me. If you look at, so Leonardo da Vinci invented the tank, invented scuba gear, invented, you know, these things, that, you know, an early helicopter, things they should have never had back then, of course. And one of the things that he drew up was a flying device. And it looks like a kind of almost like a wing. And when you look at Bill Finger and Bob Kane, who are the creators of Batman, when Bill Finger first did the drawings, and Bob Kane, for, you know, was they basically say that it was Leonardo da Vinci that originally inspired Batman's big flowing cape. So I can credit, you know, Leonardo with many things, but without Leonardo da Vinci, there is no Batman. And I love that.
Hmm. Okay, Brad, no gold in Fort Knox. Say this isn't so.
Listen, I wish I could tell you the answer. And anyone that says they know the answer, unless they were in there themselves, the last time anyone saw the gold in Fort Knox was 1974. That was the last public audit. And I was asked to speak up at Fort Knox, and you know, I kind of rolled my eyes at the idea that there's no gold in there. And then we had this security guard who came on the show, and he said, I was guarding the gold in Fort Knox, and I had my gun, and I said to my supervisor, I said, there's no bullets in my gun. I need bullets. And he said, you don't need bullets. You're not guarding anything. There's no gold in Fort Knox. And I again said, well, you know, that's one guy. Let's see what we got. We found Senator Huddleston, who was actually the senator from Kentucky, where Fort Knox is. He was one of the people there in 1974 who saw the gold. And we went to him and said, is the gold in Fort Knox? And he said, you know what? I don't know anymore. And we said, what if it's not there? He says, I'd run for the hills. This is not some crazy person. This is the senator from the state. And it's an amazing story. And of course, it begs the question, if the gold is there, why not show us what's there? And what I love that we do in the chapter in History Decoded is we do show you what has also been stored in Fort Knox. And it's amazing. The government has over the years not just hid gold there.
Which begs the question, what's there?
You really want me to ruin it?
Yeah.
Okay, so I won't ruin everything because you got to leave something for surprise. But at one point, when they were fearful for their safety, we actually even stored the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution there. Mm-hmm. Because it was so, just again, think about where it was. It was safe from attack when they thought people were going to attack Washington, D.C. And I love that the government takes this place that we know from James Bond movies, Fort Knox, and still uses it as a safe house.
Huh. Well, of course, your number one conspiracy is the JFK assassination, and so timely as it's the 50th anniversary. So many elements could be seen as conspiratorial, like the umbrella man at the airport. Can you share one or two of the truly obscure ones that you cover in your chapter?
Yeah. You want me to do the umbrella man because it's such a fun one. So there's a guy you can see in one of the pictures in the background of a photo on this beautiful day in the middle of Dallas on November 22nd is a guy who's holding an umbrella. And you, of course, begs the question, why is a guy on a clear day holding an umbrella and standing there not moving, creepily, just holding this umbrella above his head when there's not a single drop in the sky? And everyone says, it's a signal. He opened his umbrella and Oswald knew to take the shot. It's a signal. There's only one problem with that theory, is what he really is doing is he's protesting JFK and likening JFK to Neville Chamberlain. His Chamberlain used to carry an umbrella, and he said that Chamberlain was an appeaser, and he thought that JFK was an appeaser too. So while JFK's limo and motorcade made its way through Dealey Plaza, he stood with his umbrella to say, you're an appeaser just like Chamberlain. But again, that doesn't stop people from looking at it and saying, my gosh, look, it's a secret code, it's a secret message, that's how Oswald knew to take the shot, it's a giant umbrella opening up.
Well, Brad, I always love to read and speak with you. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And now let's hear a sampling of History Decoded, the 10 greatest conspiracies of all time, narrated by Scott Brick.
It was Good Friday on April 14th, 1865, 2 days after Robert E. Lee surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox, Virginia. President and Mrs. Lincoln made plans to attend the play Our American Cousin at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. John Wilkes Booth, 26, a handsome, well-known stage actor, think of him as sort of the Brad Pitt of his day, made his own plans for the theater that night, and those plans involved a .44-caliber Derringer. Booth had a dark side. He was an obsessed, fanatical supporter of the Confederate cause. Upon learning that President and Mrs. Lincoln would be attending a performance of renowned actress Laura Keene in the popular comedy Our American Cousin at Ford's Theater in Washington, Booth decided to exact revenge for the Union victory by plotting Lincoln's assassination. Ford's Theater was the perfect place for Booth to stage his final performance. As a famous actor, Booth was friends with the owner. He had been in the theater's inaugural play. He even got his mail delivered there. Booth knew the place inside out. This was home turf. On the night he shot President Lincoln, he didn't even try to conceal his identity. He walked in the front door while the performance was still in progress, said hello to the people who recognized him, and then made his way to the hallway outside the president's private box. Presidential security back then was nothing like it is today. Lincoln generally traveled with one or two guards, and conveniently on this night, the man who was supposed to be guarding the door to the box wasn't even there. He left the theater to get a drink with some of his friends. So Booth peered through the peephole in the door that he's said to have drilled earlier that day to see inside. There was no guard inside the president's box, just Lincoln, his wife, and another couple. Booth had even memorized the play. He waited until the big laugh line. Don't know the manners of good society, eh? Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, old gal, you sockdologizing old man-trap. If Will Ferrell delivered that line today, you would still hear crickets. But in 1865, it brought the house down. When the big joke hit and everyone laughed, all Booth had to do was open the unlocked door, walk up behind the president, and shoot him. His deed done, Booth stabbed a military officer who tried to stop him as he leaped from the box to the stage, 11 feet below. Landing hard, Booth rose and delivered the last line he would ever speak on stage, the most famous line of his life. Sic semper tyrannis, he cried, the Latin phrase making clear Booth's sentiments. Thus always to tyrants. Chaos erupted throughout the theater. Some say Booth broke his leg when he landed. On pure adrenaline, Booth ran out the stage door, mounted his waiting horse, and galloped into the night. History tells us that 2 weeks later, John Wilkes Booth was surrounded in a Virginia barn and killed by Union troops. Case closed. But for decades, Booth's family members have offered a different version of events. Joanne Hume, a distant relative of John Wilkes Booth, claims when she was a little girl, her mother shared with her the truth about how Booth died. They're going to say that he died in a barn. He did not die in a barn. He lived for many, many years. Booth, along with David Harold, a confidant and fellow Confederate sympathizer, fled on horseback through Maryland into Virginia. They were traveling at high speed, covering 14 miles in a matter of 2 hours, pausing to collect previously hidden weapons and supplies from the Surratt House, a tavern in Clinton, Maryland. Booth never got off his horse and probably wasn't there for more than 5 minutes.
That was History Decoded, the 10 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time by Brad Meltzer.
you know their stories. You've read the Brothers Grimm. You've watched the Disney cartoons. You cheered as virtuous women lived happily ever after. But the lives of some real princesses could not be more different. Though many were graceful and benevolent leaders, many were ruthless in their quest for power, and all had skeletons rattling in their royal closets. Princess Stephanie von Hohenlohe was a Nazi spy. Princess Olga of Kiev murdered thousands of men. And Princess Rani Lakshmibai waged war on the battlefield, charging into combat with her toddler son strapped to her back. Princesses Behaving Badly, Real Stories from History Without the Fairy Tale Endings by Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie offers mini biographies of these princesses and dozens more. Fascinating tales for feminists and history buffs alike. Cassandra Campbell narrates.
Every girl pretends she is a princess at one point. Lindy, from Alex Finn's Beastly. Every little girl? Not quite. When I was growing up, I didn't want to be a princess. I wasn't a tomboy or anything, I just wasn't into them. Horses, yes, especially the unicorn or winged, or best of all, winged unicorn kind. But then again, when I was a little girl, the Disney princess wasn't the glittery, pastel-colored juggernaut it is today. You could be a little girl and not limit your dress-up choices to Belle, Ariel, or Cinderella, or Mulan or Merida if you're feeling feisty. Nowadays, princess obsession is the default setting for many little girls. In 2000, Disney decided to market the doe-eyed denizens of its feature films by their primary identifying characteristic— their princess titles. And thus was born the princess plague. Princesses are now the biggest industry for the pre-tween set. In 2012, the Disney Princess media franchise was the best-selling of its kind in North America, outselling Star Wars and Sesame Street and earning more than $4.6 billion worldwide. Add to that all the collateral stuff. The Princess and the Pop Star Barbies, the Melissa and Doug Decorate Your Own Princess Mirror sets, countless pink spangled princess t-shirts, and you've got what social commentators and worried parents are calling the Princess Industrial Complex. In her fascinating book, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Peggy Orenstein examines the obsession with bundling girls into pink and pretty princess costumes. Orenstein, among many others, worries that princess play presents unrealistic expectations of feminine beauty, is overly restrictive, pink ball gown or purple, and is turning little girls into budding narcissists. So do I. Though no direct evidence supports claims that the ubiquitous princess culture harms girls' self-esteem, it seems to me that the phenomenon smacks of an unjustified sense of entitlement— a kind of fake power derived not from good decision-making skills or leadership or intelligence, but physical attractiveness, wealth, and relationships with strong male characters. Princess is a title that establishes bizarre expectations of how one should be treated, of what has value, and of what women will or should achieve in their lives. Obviously, most little girls don't grow up believing that life is all dress-up heels, fairy godmothers, and prince charmings. But the princess fantasy is one that we don't ever really give up. Witness the fascination with Kate Middleton, the pretty girl-next-door commoner who married Britain's dashing Prince William in April 2011. Though she's technically not a princess, her official title is Duchess of Cambridge, Catherine's story has all the hallmarks of a fairy tale. The royal wedding even looked like a cartoon. I almost expected to see twittering bluebirds carrying Kate's train. Sweetly two-dimensional Princess Kate was the image that tabloids the world over traded on, despite the grim reality of what happened to the last British princess given the fairy tale treatment. Blonde, blue-eyed Diana was Cinderella. A similarity not lost on media then or now. Diana's real story, however, her marriage of convenience, her husband's infidelity, rumors of her own unfaithfulness, struggles with fame and eating disorders, her courtship of the British press, and her eventual death after being chased by paparazzi is distinctly not the happy fairy tale everyone hoped for. Perhaps the best way to make sure that the fairy tale doesn't become the expectation is to talk about real princesses and to stop turning their lives into fairy tales. Some real princesses were women who found themselves in circumstances they couldn't control. Sophia Dorothea of Celle, for example, was forced to marry a man she called Pig Snout, a man who violently assaulted her, cheated on her, and after she retaliated by having her own affair, locked her in a castle for more than 3 decades until her death. Others, like Anna of Saxony, were genuinely mentally unstable.
That was Princesses Behaving Badly by Linda Rodriguez McRobbie. If you think Carl Hyacin's wildest, wackiest stories have all made it into his best-selling novels, think again. Dance of the Reptiles, Rampaging Tourists, Larcenous Legislators, Crazed Celebrities, and Tarballed Beaches collects Hyacin's best Miami Herald columns, which demonstrate anew that truth is stranger than fiction. Hyacin offers his commentary indignant, disbelieving, sometimes righteously angry, and frequently hilarious on burning issues like animal welfare, polluted rivers, the broken criminal justice system, the Bernie Madoff trial, and the shenanigans of recent presidential elections. Whether or not you've read Hyacin before, you're in for a wild ride. Artie Johnson narrates.
It's been almost 12 years since Paradise Screwed was published as the second collection of Carl Hyacin's newspaper columns written for the Miami Herald, and almost 15 years since the first appeared. Since then, Hyacin has written some 600 weekly op-ed columns for the Herald, in addition to 5 novels for adults, a nonfiction book about golf, and 4 novels for young adults. The first of those, Hoot, which launched Hyacin's career in that genre, told the story of Mullet Fingers, a boy who relocates surveyor stakes to stop an illegally sited development that would destroy the habitat of burrowing owls. Hoot won a prestigious Newbery Honor Book Award, its plotline mirroring Hyacin's own life. He did pull up surveyor stakes with his friends in youthful opposition to the paving of Florida. Over time, much of Hyacin's attention has, in fact, been aimed at young people who always inherit a future and who invigorate him with the writing energy he needs to continue railing against the destruction of his beloved state. As Hyacin says, "I want there to be something wonderful left of Florida for them to see and experience." Perhaps as he himself did when he was just 6 and his father took him fishing in the Keys for the first time. An adventure recounted in his well-known essay, The Florida Keys. Something precious is falling apart. As he observes, you stay and fight, because otherwise you're surrendering. Such continuity and consistency, essential to Hyacin as a person and a writer, are clear in this latest collection of columns. In Dance of the Reptiles, Hyacin resumes his verbal war against greed, corruption, ignorance, and hypocrisy, addressing such issues as hurricanes, offshore drilling, and water, all of which occupy center stage nationally. Devastating storms like Hurricane Sandy, for example, roared across the northern states of New York and New Jersey, capturing national attention. For years, however, Hyacin has written about massive storms in Florida, not only flattening entire communities, but also driving up insurance premiums by splintering flimsily constructed homes and flooding coastal properties overbuilt to begin with. Offshore drilling is another topic Hyacin tackled almost 30 years ago. His urgent warnings poignant now that British Petroleum's deepwater horizon inevitably blew, spewing some 206 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. In a 1987 column entitled, U.S. Points Out the Bright Side of Oil Spills, Hyacin lampooned a government report asserting there was only a 48% chance that a major spill would smear the beaches within 35 years. The study also claimed that offshore oil exploration is abundantly safe, and that advanced equipment should minimize damage to reefs, tidal banks, water quality, and marine life. A 50-50 chance for an ecological disaster isn't so bad, Hyacin Riley stated, concluding with an invitation to the Interior Secretary to hurry on down before he had to tiptoe through the tar balls. And, of course, there's the issue of water. Surrounded on three sides, Florida remains vulnerable to all storms. Hurricanes can rip across oil derricks yet to be built or gas lines yet to be dug, with the potential for future catastrophe very real to the coastline, the wildlife, the economy. Any construction in those sensitive waters makes Hyacin cringe, especially since the state has problems with drinkable water. Its supply is drying up. The sustained pollution of wetlands and rivers, which have been drained, paved, or contaminated by runoff and pulp residue, all permitted by questionable legislation, has reduced and diminished Florida. Nature is interconnected, Hyacin would say, and fragile.
That was Dance of the Reptiles by Carl Hyacin. To Plutarch, a seer warned Caesar that harm would come to him no later than the Ides of March. On his way to the theater of Pompeii, where he would be assassinated, Caesar passed the seer and joked, "The Ides of March have come," meaning the prophecy had not been fulfilled. But the seer replied, "I, Caesar, but not gone." As we pass the Ides of March, I hope you've enjoyed this look at the titles that chronicle turning points in our history. Events big and small, far-reaching, some funny, all, I hope you'll agree, intriguing. For more histories or other ideas, if fiction is your preference, consult my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in 1 week for the next edition of The Book Report.